Welcome to the School of the Forest podcast, episode 17. Welcome to the School of the Forest podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Russell. This podcast aims to educate you about outdoor living skills, give you a first-person approach to wilderness ecology, and provide you with a glimpse into the different methods people are using for sustainable living. To find out more about our programs, please visit schooloftheforest.com. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, everybody. We're back again real soon after the last one, which is sort of the trend here, is I do a couple and then get busy and don't do any for a while. And so we're here. I'm joined with an acquaintance and friend that I have only ever interacted with online, which is a new one for me. I'm here with Steve Wood of the Backyard Zoology sort of Instagram account, and kind of, I guess you kind of run it like a blog more than anything. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing all right.
So do you want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself and kind of what you've been doing with that project?
Yeah, well, I'm Steve Wood. I'm the Backyard Zoologist. I have an Instagram account and Facebook page. I'm cataloging local wildlife in the area that I live in, which is upstate New York. I live in a small town called Tully, New York, which is about 15 minutes south of Syracuse. Very rural area, mountains. Well, big hills. I say mountains because it sounds more romantic, but you know, it's a very hilly area, lots of forests, lots of farmland. Fairly rural, not heavily populated. I think we have maybe 3,000 people in the town of Tully, so not urban whatsoever. I moved up here 2 years ago from the city of Syracuse and was overwhelmed with the amount of wildlife I had, and started cataloging it and started an Instagram page to do that, which is awesome. So that's who I am.
Yeah, so that's I discovered Steve's work through through my work with the Vermont Natural History Museum, and really enjoyed the way that you've been cataloging those, and specifically because a lot of the programs that I run through School of the Forest are about like local ecology, as opposed to learning a lot about someplace you don't really ever get to interact with. My sort of mentor and friend Tim Smith, who runs Jack Mountain Bushcraft School, has this great story about picking up his kids from a school in rural New Hampshire and hearing a teacher tell those kids not to eat the red berries on a tree. And he teaches wilderness stuff, and in his brain he was thinking those are cherries, those are incredibly edible. But at that same time, those kids were doing a unit on like the Amazon rainforest. So it's just this weird kind of disconnect. So seeing, most days I get to pull up Instagram and see kind of a species that you document really well, not just in the photography, but in your sort of knowledge of them. That's a fascinating thing, I think, not just for me, but for the other people that get to see what you're doing and learn a little bit about. I guess at some point this joke is going to get made, but see what's right outside their back door, right?
Yeah. I think it's a cool project. And also, I think you and I probably share quite a bit of wildlife. I mean, we're in pretty much the same kind of region.
Yeah.
Pretty much parallel or horizontal to one another. So we probably have a lot of carryover with wildlife. And, you know, I have to remember with the page, things that are really, really common to me and not exciting and non-charismatic stuff is very exciting to people in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. And, you know, it's funny. I post a picture of a blue jay and, they're such a pain in the butt. And I have so many of them. And I always think, oh yeah, there's a blue jay, you know, across the country or overseas. People are like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. I can't believe, oh, I wish I had those. Yeah, maybe you don't. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I do love the blue jays though. So I can't say much bad about them. So, okay.
So I actually, it's interesting that you picked the blue jay. I have, so for me, I grew up homeschooled and my mother had this clock that was all the bird calls. I'm sure you've seen those. And
yes.
And I, for the longest time, I couldn't figure out why blue jays call Even now as an adult, the call is incredibly annoying to me. And it wasn't until probably a few years ago that I put together that the time of like 11 o'clock was when the Blue Jay sound went off on a clock. And that was also the time to do math. And I don't very much like math. So I think I had like associated those two things together. But yeah, that's an interesting thing as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you kind of got the idea to start doing this? Like, where did this kind of, where was this born?
Well, you know, I've worked in human services and communicable disease for years and years and years, and primarily around HIV. I started working in the HIV field around 1985, back in the bad, bad old days. I lived in Boston and worked for Harvard University. So, you know, that's kind of my foundation, and getting exposed to science and getting exposed to all kinds of things. I was interested in science as a young person, but I was terrible. And I was a horrible student, really, really horrible. So I never had confidence to explore science fields or anything. But working in human services or the administrative field kind of gave me a good exposure. I moved back to Syracuse about 25 years ago and just continued to do education and stuff around communicable disease. When I moved out here to Tully, well, no, actually before that, when I was in my 40s, I decided I needed to go back to school. I had had an associate's in broadcasting and I needed a bachelor's, I needed a higher degree, just an associate's. And I thought, you go back for human services, social work or whatever, and you'd be awesome at that. But I'm so sick of social work after so many years of doing it that I don't want to do it any longer. So I thought, all right, get a degree in zoology. If you fail at it, you fail at it, but at least you tried and you can explore, you know, all these things that you want to know about and all the things I didn't want to know about, like chemistry and statistics and all that stuff that I really, really struggled with. But went back to school, came out top of my class, did some really great work, did some great papers that got a lot of attention, and was working at an agency just doing education for providers, for doctors, nurses, human service workers, things like that. That contract ended. I was unemployed. I was in my last semester of school, and I thought, okay, I'm just going to finish out college and see what happens. And along came a job at our local zoo. And I wasn't a huge fan of zoos, but it was a great opportunity. Up here, there's not a lot of work for these types of degrees. So wonderful job doing education at a zoo. I really got a great perspective of why we have zoos, what they're all about, who the animals are, things like that. Unfortunately, that job did not pay a living wage whatsoever. So another agent here in Syracuse called me and said, hey, you want to come work for us? I was like, yeah, I got to have a job. So, all right. I've been doing that for about 10 years. But when I moved out here to Tully, I was just blown away by this area. It's gorgeous. So, you know, I have 6 acres. And I noticed the amount of wildlife here was astounding. And I wanted to know more about it. I never took entomology when I was in college. You know, you have a certain number of credits that you have to acquire, and you've got to pick and choose your electives. And entomology was just one of those ones that fell by the wayside. And I wish I had taken it, because that is the abundance of wildlife that anybody will probably see are, you know, insects and arachnids and all that stuff. So I started researching that. I started looking up stuff, taking pictures using iNaturalist or whatever. I think Picture Insect was the app at the time. And I would post it on my personal Facebook page, and people would say, oh, you should do something with this. You should have a YouTube channel. I don't want to do a YouTube channel. Oh, you should go on TikTok. I don't want to do TikTok. Although I am horrifyingly addicted to TikTok right now. So who knows? It's like a drug. I don't know what's up with TikTok. But
all that social media stuff is like that.
Right. So I had an Instagram account, and I thought, why not do an Instagram account? Call it the Backyard Zoologist, because that's a cool concept. And let's catalog everything that lives around me, what it's doing here, how it interacts with the ecosystem, how it interacts with each other, and what the impact is. I'm in a high agriculture area. And, you know, obviously, a lot of it is livestock agriculture, but a big, big portion up here is fruit agriculture. So there's a lot of talk about pest insects and things like that. And let me go out and do some education around all these insects and all these birds and all the small mammal and reptile, amphibian wildlife that live around me, and educate the community about it so they're less afraid of it, they're less suspicious of it, they're more interested in it, and encourage people to get outside. Along with that, where I'm going with this long rambling story, and I'm sorry about that, is along with that came this concept of backyard conservation. Somebody had said they liked what I'm doing with backyard conservation. I thought, well, I've never heard that term. What is that? I gave it a lot of thought. And I thought, yes, it is exactly what I'm doing on one level, just by educating the community about wildlife. But I think we can do a little bit more with it. And I got really excited about the idea of using a methodology that we use in HIV and substance use services, which is harm reduction. And harm reduction is anything you do to protect yourself is better than doing nothing at all. So out of the next 10 times you partake in risky behavior, try to protect yourself once. Then we can work your way up to, you know, better habits. We can apply that to conservation. One little thing you do in your yard or in your area or in your state or county or whatever, do one thing to help the environment. And that's harm reduction. And it's a great concept that can be applied over into this conservation effort. The reality is things like climate change, species collapse, environmental justice, all of those things are huge, huge topics. And it's hard for people to wrap their heads around it. And it's hard for people without a background in science to really get an idea of what that's about. Let's break it down to something very simple. Make a compost pile. You know, repurpose old sticks and logs from your environment to make garden walls or something. You know, invite local life in or invite birds in. Don't kill that bug. Just simple things like that. So that's kind of my new mission. That's something I'm really focusing on in the next few months. And with winter coming, I have a lot more time to dedicate to this. So I think that's where I'm going to go with it. So I'm sorry that was a long rambling thing, but that's how I am sometimes.
No, I try to keep this podcast relatively profanity free, but that rambling deserves a resounding hell yeah. Like it is.
Okay, good.
It is. Most of the programs that we run are based around this idea of deep ecology, which is very similar to what you're talking about, where everything is super interconnected down to, you know, the mycelium layer and all that stuff.
Exactly.
And trying to get people to, the more they understand those connections, the more likely they are to actually care about what's around them, right?
Exactly.
And that's the purpose of education as far as conservation goes, is getting people to learn about that stuff so that they see the value in all the things that are around them. You were mentioning entomology earlier and how it kind of slips by the wayside. I've talked to a lot of people that spend a lot of time outdoors, but don't know a lot of, I'm one of them. You know, I knew a couple here and there. And what I found is interesting that if you can find a way to have them interact with it, then the curiosity starts. So for us, on a lot of the programs we run, it's usually around fly fishing. Like the person couldn't care less about insects or arthropods or anything, but then they start tying flies and they have to make those flies look accurate for the brook trout to care about them. And then they get into, and then it's just this deep dive, right? And that's, it's because they're interacting with it and they're starting to care about it. And then it matters to them that, you know, if that insect isn't here because it can't live in the water because it's polluted, then I can't continue to go fly fishing or whatever activity it is to do, because that's, insects aren't there, the fish aren't there. It's this really fascinating, like, interconnected web. Yeah, again, I say hell yeah to that.
That's, I think, great. Once you start looking at the local insects too, I mean, you know, there's ones that, you know, everybody knows monarch butterflies, everybody knows certain types of insects. When you start taking a deeper dive into it, and I'm still discovering new stuff. This year we had these little golden metallic looking tiny beetles, and I was amazed at them. I had never seen them before. They were everywhere this year. They look like little destructive disco balls all over all over our plants. So you're always going to discover new stuff. And, you know, with the use of apps and things like that, and I'm not ashamed to say I utilize iNaturalist constantly, trying to get an idea on things because I don't know what everything is. I think that's one of the misconceptions about those of us in these fields is people will send me pictures of insects or some animal and say, what is this? I don't know.
Yeah.
<You know>?
Yeah.
I don't know everything. I can find out. But
the one we get the most up here is somebody will come to me with a leaf that they've had in their pocket for the last 3 hours and ask me what it is. I have absolutely no way of telling what that was at any point.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But so these golden beetles, what did they end up being?
They were hanging out on some sweet potato vine, you know, some cultivated pots and things like that. And they did a number on them. I was adamant, you're not going to kill them. Let's leave them as is. They hung around. They're gone. They've been gone for a long, long time. But they were early spring arrivals. They were tiny, about the size of a pinhead. If you touch them, they turn brown, which I thought was super cool.
Whoa.
Like a coppery color. So they were here. I'm sure they'll be back next year. A lot of insects that may be semi-native, I don't know how to put it better, come in on our cultivated plants that we buy at garden centers and things like that. So, you know, occasionally you're going to find these unusual things that pop up and overpopulate your area. You know, things balance out eventually.
Yeah, it's a super interesting thing to, you know, so I spend half the year in Vermont and the other half right now I'm up in northern Maine running our long-term program. So getting to see, it's almost like a shock to the system bouncing back and forth to where stuff that is usually around you and you can really use to seeing just isn't there all the time.
Right.
You know, the one that I think about up here is the gray dude. We, every day, we get to interact with them. We have students that, where they like land on their shoulders and take oats mm-hmm. from stuff because they're not afraid of anything. They become like this, friend is probably too strong a word, but it's that's somewhere along that. Like you're interacting with the species every day and learning about it. And then you go somewhere else where they aren't anymore. It feels like a loss, like missing. Right. Something's missing. And I think that that's probably true the other way, where all of a sudden things are showing up that aren't, you're not used to it. Kind of like, you know, in most cases, it probably elicits curiosity, but I imagine it's also sometimes a little jarring. Feel like right. you know the way. So you mentioned earlier your sort of approach of reduced harm or reduced risk to right. conservation. And you wrote an article for a book called Connections with Nature that talked about that. I would love to hear more about that. I'd love to hear more about the book in general.
Early on, when I had the Instagram account, I got hooked up with a group called the Wildlife Blogger Crowd. It's based in the UK, and the woman who runs it is very active, very supportive of everybody. I think it's part of her job. I think this is her job, part of her job to promote other conservationists and other wildlife advocates and activists and climate change activists and promote that. So she had gotten a publishing deal through a British publishing company to do an anthology. And she had asked for submissions from people who were members of the group. So I wrote up something at the last minute, which is a bad habit of mine, just about how to get outside, how to appreciate the wildlife, appreciate the world around you, and things like that. So, you know, it's a short page and a half. But it's exciting and I'm happy to be a part of it. And, you know, I think that's, you know, that's always my message is just get outdoors.
Yeah. So to that, do you have a, you know, like you were saying, you're kind of posting pictures of whatever you find, but do you have a particular species that you really like getting to interact with that kind of draws your attention and you can't focus on anything else?
You know,
or a family.
Yeah, you know, it changes by the day. Whatever. I mean, as you can see behind me, dogs are probably the number one, regardless if they're domesticated wildlife. you know, it just changes by the day. There are certain things I love to eat. For some reason, I absolutely love isopods. I don't know why. Maybe because they look like little mini trilobites. Crustaceans, things like that. I love them. I don't see too many crustaceans other than isopods. But, you know, I think it's easier for me to identify what I don't like interacting with, which I think people always believe that, you know, if you're in this field, you must love all animals. I don't like ants whatsoever. I can't explain that. And we all, you know, I live in harmony with ants. I have a gigantic anthill in one of my gardens. We've planted a bunch of peonies. The ants love that. I'm happy. Okay, fine. Just don't get on me. Don't get in my house. Yeah. Don't try to interact with me. I don't know what it is. It turns me into like a 7-year-old girl when one's on me. Ah, you know.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing that you bring up is sometimes the ones you interact with are not your favorite ones. Like the ones you interact with the most tend to become your least favorite. I've done a lot of work with corvids worked really extensively with Remy, who's the raven at the Southern Vermont Natural History Museum. And I love that bird to death, but like ravens in general, I'm fascinated by them, but they're kind of hard to be around. Like it's like being with a petulant 8-year-old all the time, you know? Like if somebody asked me my favorite, which often happens on programs, I think because I talk about the work with her, they assume that it would be a raven or something like that. What is the absence makes the heart grow fonder kind of thing. Like the longer I'm away from Remy, the more I like the idea of being around her. But on occasion, man, she's tough. I bet that's probably true of any kind of wildlife you're interacting with a lot.
I do like corvids a lot.
They are fascinating.
You know, we have, like I mentioned earlier, we have a lot of blue jays here, which are corvids. I've been trying desperately to become friends with the crows around here, but they're not interested in being friends with me. So whatever. I feel
it's hard to win over.
I know.
Really hard.
Out here in the country, it's a little different than when I lived in the city. The crows were pretty bold out in the city. Out here in the country, they are not. Yeah. So just different attitudes, you know?
Yeah, we had, I'm up here at the field school in Maine, that we had a nesting pair of ravens earlier this spring, and I did everything I could to get them used to me, read everything I could, trying to just kind of interact with them more and more, and they weren't having it. The male was one that had for a while lived pretty close to where my tent is on the property. He had a bum wing for a couple of years and hung out around there. So he could deal with me, but mama wasn't impressed.
And you're right.
What she said goes.
You know, I do love woodpeckers, and we have quite a few of them here. Quite a few different species. I think I have 5 or 6 different species. I love woodpeckers, and I think it's anybody that can smash their face against a tree for an hour and act like it's nothing, that you've got my respect.
Yeah, and just the like adaptations they have for that are so fascinating. Like
exactly.
And I, you know, we were talking about it earlier, like this interaction or like some sort of, you know, maybe you see this differently, but I've been fascinated by this sort of shift in a lot of sort of modern biologists. You know, I think of like Ben Killam or Bernd Heinrich, these people that have kind of shrugged off that idea that when you're interacting with the natural world, you're kind of like not touching it and just observing it. And then these two people just come to my mind because they're the ones I've read where they started interacting more heavily. And through that, we learned even more about these species, stuff we never would have figured out. And so that kind of idea is fascinating, where you anthropomorphize this creature, you know, like a woodpecker watching something beat its head against something, feels it resonates with you. And then how can they do that?
I'm glad, I'm really glad you brought up the term entomorphosize. I can never say the word, but I'm glad you brought that up. You know, I do it constantly. And when I worked at the zoo, some of the hardcore people that work there really hated that I did that. But it's a great educational tool to use. And I'm not humanizing wildlife. I'm not humanizing an animal. I'm not giving them human qualities. But to talk about an animal having emotions and thoughts and connections and things like that, I think is key to doing wildlife education. Clearly things feel stuff and clearly things have relationships, just not in the way that we do. And I think it's important too. I don't think there's a problem with doing that at all. Now, other people may disagree with me and that's fine. But I think it's a great tool for education and it warms people up to stuff. When I worked at the zoo, there was a huge boa constrictor who had a great story. And people were really repulsed by snakes, obviously. And a lot of visitors to the zoo were mortified by her. But I would tell them her story and what she's all about and what she does. And it kind of warmed people up to her. And we're like, oh, well, that's really cool. You know, and this is her name and things like that. So, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Like if you're interacting with stuff on a daily basis, like we as a species are not wired to not see ourselves, right? And that's where that caring that we're talking about comes from, I think.
Right.
At least for me.
Right.
So with that, we're kind of coming up on the half hour mark, which is usually around where we aim for. So do you have kind of like thoughts or advice for anybody, specifically young people that want to get involved with working with or studying wildlife? Because hearing your story, and then knowing how kind of my life went as well, is like, if somebody had steered me on this path earlier, I would have found my life's purpose way earlier in life, and it would have been awesome.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as a young person, if you're listening to this and you're interested in a science career, explore it, do it, and go to school. If it's not working out for you, if you don't like it, then change your major. But do it. And I don't care if you're 18. I don't care if you're 45 or 50 or 60. If you're interested in it, do it. It's not impossible. And I mean, I did it in my 40s. And I'll tell you, going back to school as an adult is pretty awesome. You have a whole different perspective. But for young people, get involved in the sciences, read, get involved in activism, get involved in change, because that's where the key is. Understand your environment. I know how privileged I am living where I am with 6 acres of property. I know not everybody has this. Not everybody has access to this. Some people have a tiny space. Some people have no space. Some people live in places where it's safe to go outside. But you can still get involved and you can still do stuff. Do it. Get outdoors. Go to school. Put yourself on the path for these types of careers. The earlier you do it, the better. When you're 22 and you're working, you know, a not so great paying lab tech job, that's okay, because you'll work your way up. The world's always changing and we need to change with it. So for young people, do it. And I think, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about environmental justice and involving marginalized populations in the sciences, whether that's racial minorities or LGBT people or whoever. And I think that's a great movement. And that's something we should really think about too, is how do we engage marginalized communities to get involved in science? I can tell you, when I worked in labs, women were pretty well represented in the labs, but they weren't leading the research. And I hope there's been a change. I saw very few LGBTQ people at all working in the sciences. And I hope that's changing too. So get involved with it, explore it. If you don't like it, you don't like it, that's okay. God, science is such a massive, massive field. So is conservation, huge. You can find a niche that you're gonna like. And you're going to find a niche that you can do something cool with. So just look into it. And if you're in high school, talk to your science teachers, talk to your guidance counselors and see what happens. The one advice I would give people is, I don't know about Vermont, I don't know about Maine, but here in New York, we have all of these requirements when you're in college, these general education requirements. They have nothing to do with what you want to study, you know, your Western civilization and things like that. Get it out of the way at community college. Go cheap. It's the same curriculum as your other state schools. So do it. And then go to a four-year school for your junior and senior year and study the stuff you love. Do the intensive stuff. So there's my advice.
That's going to be the second hell yeah you get out of me, Steve. I got to be honest with you. Good. That's pretty awesome. Cool. Well, so the way I usually wrap these up is asking about like one particular experience that you had in nature that has kind of like, it sticks with you. You think about it once a month, maybe more. And you know, that could be, it could be something funny. We had one guy, a friend of mine who works at the DART program. He's a wilderness EMT. And his like the memory that stuck with him was, an outhouse on a peak in Siberia that you saw, and it was just the most like weird thing. So it doesn't have to be anything super compelling. It can just be anything that sticks with you.
I think I've given this a little bit of thought, and there's a few things that happen, but I think the one thing that always stands out to me lately is this spring, actually. You know, after a really rough winter, we had a super, super snowy winter here. We got 4 feet of snow overnight one night. And we were all stuck inside for days and weeks. And as soon as, you know, the spring came along, the ground warmed up, the ground dried out, I went outside and it was a beautiful sunny day. And I sat down on the ground and I thought, oh my God, this is what it is. This is what it's about. You just feel that connection. And this is so touchy-feely, and it's not very much like me. I'm not a real touchy-feely, metaphysical kind of guy. But I felt such a connection with the earth and with everything around me, and just sat there. It was quiet. It was sunny. It was a beautiful day. And just looked at stuff and just looked at the grass and looked at the flowers and things that were growing and all the bugs cruising around. And that had a profound impact on me. I thought, more people need to do that. You need to get outside. You need to sit on the ground. You need to put your feet on the ground and just feel it. Just feel the earth. So feel that energy. It's about as new age as I get. But do it. And that's the memory.
You're edging towards the hat trick of hell yeahs here, Steve. That was awesome. I love that.
Good.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on. You got any kind of closing thoughts you want to add in or anything?
Yeah, people, get outside, look around. That's all you got to do. My tagline always is, you know, if you're good to the earth, if you are a good caretaker and you just get out and look around, then the earth is going to reward you with some amazing things. And that's my tagline. And that's what you got to do.
Amen to that. All right. Thank you very much for coming on, Steve.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem. All right. We'll see you guys all on the next one. You've been listening to the School of the Forest podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, I hope you share it with a few friends. If you did like the show, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or any other of the major podcast hosting platforms. And lastly, if you'd like to learn more about School of the Forest programs, please check us out at schooloftheforest.com and get in touch with us at any of the contact information you'll find on that site. Thanks,